Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist and author of the newly released book, Suspended Values in Concentration Camp and Prison, is back to speak on the penal system, the need to reform prisons in the U.S., and more on her book. She's going to be giving us insight into some of the things that have been discussed throughout the past months that we've been talking about it. Mariam, are you on with us?
Hello, Jenna. Leona, yes, I'm here, and thank you for inviting me again.
Thank you for being on. We're always honored to have you on. Can you introduce yourself to the audience? Just tell them a little bit about yourself, and then we can start from there.
Yes, I am Mariam Jacobs. I live in the Netherlands. And I work as a psychosocial therapist. I also visit incarcerated people in the Netherlands. That's on a voluntary base, but I use my skills as a therapist for incarcerated people who want to try to understand themselves more, get to more self-insight, and heal their wounds. That's what I also do for in my work. I have written a book that was a few months ago. It has been published. It's called Suspended Values in Concentration Camp and Prison. And in my book, I compare the underlying structure of the United States prison system and the concentration camps in World War II. And I came to the conclusion that although both systems are different on the surface, there are similarities in the underlying structures, and that was quite shocking to discover for me. So I wrote this book, and I hope that when people read it, that it makes them think about what is really happening here and what can we do to change these destructive structures.
And I wanted to add as well, Mariam, there are so many people out there that are professionals that are doing the psychological research and things like that that are going on in the country, but there are very, very few that actually do hands-on in situations as yours. You've been advocating for the incarcerated through your books, been coming on the radio show and talking about the psychological effects of solitary confinement, of restrictive housing, a lot of things that go on in the U.S. prisons. And this is something that we've been trying to encourage, along with other advocates like Donna Wynette from the Families and Friends of Individuals, Families, Friends, and Individuals of the Mentally Ill. We've been talking so much about the Department of Mental Health getting involved, as well as the American Psychological Association, which they don't seem to put as much into it as you and others that have been actually involved with the incarcerated population. So some of the things that we've been talking about as well is in some of these psychological areas is something that I'd like to have some feedback and insight from you on.
I think I try to look from a perspective that might go deeper than what we see on the surface. I always look, I don't only look at the system, but I also try to understand how the system is embedded in society. And that's why I also look at politics and economy and all these factors. And I want to try to see the whole. This perspective I also use when I talk one-on-one with incarcerated people. I don't only look at that person or that one crime, but I try to see the whole of the environment, the upbringing, character, maybe trauma. Well, there can be many different aspects what led to the crime. So I think what we should do more is look at the context around the issue, and that for me that counts on individual level, but also on systemic level. Because if we look at the United States prison system, in fact, it's a system, it's a symptom of how society functions. You have many more problems. You have homelessness, a difficult access to healthcare, the gap between poor and rich is getting bigger, environmental problems. You have a lot of privatization. That's a huge problem. I think it's very important to take all these factors into account if you try to find solutions for this symptom that we call United States incarceration. It's not an isolated problem. It has, it's linked to much more, and it also has to do with the mindset. You know, we should wonder why are we capable of destroying living human beings just for the sake of revenge or whatever. So we have to, yeah, we have to look at ourselves. Yeah, that's what I want to finish with, that we have to turn our vision around and look ourselves in the eyes. And that's the start, I think.
And, you know, this is what's lacking in the United States and in the government, is that they fail to look at these issues that you're talking about. One of the things is like the death penalty. I find the death penalty to be something that should be abolished because it's almost like executing people that have executed others. It's like murdering people that have murdered others. And to me, that doesn't seem like a punishment. That seems like a retaliation more so. And then later down the road, finding out that a lot of these people who have been put to death were innocent. So who is held accountable in situations like that? Because someone is in government or because someone has a title or a uniform that entitles them to be able to murder and finding out that the person was innocent after? And it's also giving mixed messages to the children, the youth that are watching all of this and hearing about this. What are your thoughts on the death penalty?
Well, I am very much against the death penalty too, because you cannot, I don't believe in killing somebody as a punishment, because it's irreversible. If you talk about punishment, it should be that somebody learns from his mistakes, but killing somebody in prison, there's nothing to learn from that. So it only has to do with retaliation and revenge. There's no other reason to kill somebody who is incarcerated in prison. And then I come to power play. This is a form of power play. You know, the need to overpower other people. I think it needs a lot of courage, and it needs a lot of, you have to be able to be self-reflective. I don't know if that's an English word, but that you are capable of looking at yourself and then look at the incarcerated individual and give him a chance to rehabilitate. Rehabilitate is the only solution. There are not less crimes when you have death penalty. It doesn't help anybody, not even the family of the victim. It doesn't even help them because it keeps them in bitterness. And this whole the system, while the prison system, especially from the Western countries in the United States, is not based on rehabilitation. That's nonsense. When I look at these websites of correctional institutions, it's nonsense. There is no rehabilitation. There might be an exception of somebody who is able to rehabilitate himself or herself in prison, but those are exceptions. And when something like that happens, then it gets all the attention in media in order to make incarceration look like it's about rehabilitation, but it's not. It's really sick what's happening in the United States prisons. It's really sick.
You know, when
it's
I think about
it, camp. Yeah.
When I think about it, what you're saying, it, I mean, it's so true, because we interviewed recently also Frans Del from Amsterdam. He was a former warden for 27 years, and he spoke of, and I was amazed to listen to what he was saying. Even he himself made it made an effort to meet with a population of prisoners, and how he talked about communicating with them. And one of the things I've learned from even you in the past is that you speak the same way of the treatment, the way that they interact in your country in comparison to the United States. This interaction makes a big difference from the perspective of your country and the way you interact with your clients in comparison to this country. Can you speak a little bit about that? Because there's a major difference in the results.
Now, when I speak, and I think I can also talk for my colleagues, when I speak with incarcerated people, to me, they are people like I am and like you are, like, you know, we all are. They are not different. Yes, they did commit a crime. Yes, they have to do time. But I have to say that I do not believe in incarceration. I don't know what would be a really good alternative, but I do not believe in locking up people. That's the first. But I think what's crucial in prisons is a equal, that you treat the other one equal. For me, the incarcerated individual is the other one who is like me, who has the same goals, the same dreams, the same thoughts. And I learn from a prisoner as much as he learns from me. It's equal. You know, during my other days, I work on Fridays. I have clients in prison. The other days, I do other work as a therapist. Then I work with people at home. That's a complete different story. But my approach is the same, whether I am in prison or in people's homes. And I think that makes all the difference when somebody has to heal. Rehabilitation. In my point of view, rehabilitation is something that takes place 24 hours a day in the prison. And it's not a program, it's an approach. A way of approaching incarcerated people. And it starts with little things like when you start your shift in the morning, then it's polite to say good morning, that you have a good night or something. You know what we do to our neighbors, to our friends and families, and, you know, that these little things give back to prisoners the feeling of humanity. And in a human environment, prisoners can start to think about their lives, why they did commit crime, what happened inside of them, and what they have to learn to heal themselves. But it all starts with an approach on a daily basis, and that's an approach that takes place 24 hours a day. That's not a program. That's a way of life. And that's what's missing in the prisons in the United States. Even, of course, there might be exceptions, but even I've seen even people in American in the American system who are polite, but you still feel the power. You still feel that they find themselves better than the prisoner. They stand above the prisoners. That's wrong.
You know, I find that happening as well. I'll say this for a fact. I find that happening as well with the government, legislative members who you reach out to for help with the incarcerated population. If a person is seeking assistance as an advocate, they get more respect than if a person is seeking help for an incarcerated individual that's related to them. And to me, it's whether it be in the prisons or whether it be in legislative members in the government, the attitudes and the responses are so different than if they're dealing with other government leaders, legislative members, or other people in law or whatever it may be. I find the treatment different, not only in the prisons, but unfortunately, because that treatment is different, it's almost as though when you think about the Department of Corrections prison officials, they will lie to politicians and politicians will accept it. You know, they don't challenge them. And it's almost like they're giving the power, they're giving more power to the abusers. And I think that's inappropriate myself as well, because the abusers are the ones that are supposed to be held accountable. But if government members allow this to happen, then they need to be held accountable too.
Yeah, it has to do with a lot of things. It has to do on personal level. It has to do with the fact that overall people are sensitive for power. And prisoners and their families are always the parties who are dependent. So when I go into prison, I have to be very aware of the fact that I do have power, because at the end of the session, I go home and he stays in prison. So I have to be very aware of the fact that I do have power in order not to use my power. And another thing is when, you know, there are guards or legislative members who enjoy this power, they will use it. And lying in politics, that happens a lot. I mean, you invade Iraq even based on a lie, and you killed millions of people based on lies. So you see that on all levels in politics, and you see it extremely back in the prison system. So this whole thing about power is a really huge issue, and it's also an issue with guards in when they get training, they should really learn how that they have this power and how not to use that power. So there is a lot involved in that from different sides.
I wanted to also ask as a psychosocial therapist, what are your thoughts on the mental, the psychological effects or the psychological issues that in result in incarceration?
I think what you see in the United States is that there is not much, psychological issues are not really taken into account when somebody gets a prison sentence. While it's very big, very important to separate that. We in the Netherlands, I think maybe France has talked about it too. In the Netherlands, we have forensic psychiatry. That means there are people in those clinics who did commit a crime partly based on trauma or psychological issues. So they get treatment. And that's what's lacking in the United States. I believe it was in the 70s that a lot of these clinics have closed in the United States. They have been there, but they've been closed, and that has to do with privatization. It became too expensive. It's cheaper to throw everybody in prison who makes mistakes than to look carefully at the cause of the crime.
And that's where you come in.
That's completely lacking in the United States. They don't look at it. I mean, and then, you know, when they have finished a sentence, people get their medicine, you know, in a package and are thrown into the streets. And then they have to find out for themselves what to do. So what happens? They commit crimes again because that's the only way they know their lives. Nothing has changed. So they get back, and then you get all this recidivism. The human aspect is completely absent in and around incarceration in your country. And a lot has to do with money. A lot has to do with amendments. In my book, I explained the 14th Amendment, the 13th Amendment, 5th Amendment. That's also involved. There are some very smart gaps in these amendments, which makes it possible to have mass incarceration, and that's what is happening. It's devastating for people. It's really devastating.
I know you have a Facebook page for Deeper Justice. I wanted to ask, in your book, was there any areas of deeper justice mentioned in the book? Because I found in reading not only the book, but the Deeper Justice website, Facebook page that you have, you're one of very, very few people or professionals that have actually discussed deeper justice, per se, not going after the offender and not going after the victim, or talking mostly or focusing on the victim and the offender, but actually looking at the cause of crime. In the United States, we have an epidemic of mental illnesses and addictions. But when you come on the show, you talk about these issues, whereas Department of Mental Health should be getting involved more so, as well as the American Psychological Association. But they withdraw themselves completely from these type of cases, and this is very imperative that they get involved. Because, as you say, they're not getting the treatment that they should be getting. They're getting thrown into prison, and major corporations are benefiting off of them, but no rehabilitation is being done for the majority.
No, exactly. Let me explain. When I developed this deeper justice, after I had heard about restorative justice, and for the people who do not know what it really means, restorative justice means that in the process of healing of the victim, somewhere the victim is able meets the offender, and the victim is then able to forgive the offender, and the offender can show remorse, and that's called the process of healing. It's a beautiful concept. But when I heard of it, I thought something is missing, because there are a lot of programs for victims to heal, but there is no program for offenders to heal. When an offender really wants to get to remorse, then he first needs to go through this process of awareness of what has happened, etc., etc. And I call it deeper justice because it's doing justice to yourself on a deeper level, and that's for the offender, because what I said, there are already programs for victims. I think what is missing in the United States prison system is when somebody is convicted of a crime, he is already judged in court. When I entered the prison system, I want to go beyond judgment. I am not in a position to judge the person who is sitting across me in prison. I go further than that, because if I am the next person who is also going to judge the prisoner, he cannot heal. He cannot work on himself. Judgment paralyzes. That's what I call it. But it's very difficult for a lot of people to go beyond judgment, beyond good and evil. The philosopher Nietzsche wrote a book about it. It's called Beyond Good and Evil. I want to go beyond good and evil, because if you go into the life of somebody who has committed a crime, and you hear all the aspects of his life and the environment, his context, then you come to understanding. I want to come to understanding. And when I come to understanding, then the prisoner also is able to come to understanding. And that goes way beyond judgment. And that's, for me, I am convinced that's the only path to healing. And I think if you really want to do good to inside the prison, then you should give every prisoner the opportunity to go through this process. Not everybody might be able to do that, but he should at least have the opportunity to try to do it.
Exactly.
And that's missing, because that costs a lot of money. These processes take time. And in the United States, with all this privatization, you know, it's like what the comic, the stand-up comedian George Carlin already said, I don't know, in the 70s, 80s, he said, you have no freedom, you have owners. You are owned, and we are owned by all these structures. We think we are free, but we are not free. We are all, in a way, imprisoned. But in the system, that's where you see it very clear, because they are also physically incarcerated.
And I wanted to bring up another issue. You've heard about the doctor, that the gymnastic doctor, the former Michigan State University doctor, Larry Nassar, who was stabbed multiple times for molesting the young women that were in the gymnastics. This was all over the news worldwide. He went to prison. He was stabbed at a Florida federal prison, and he was a U.S. Gymnastic doctor.
Mm-hmm. I didn't hear it because I did not hear so much news lately.
You know what I was going to say? That's probably why you just, and I want to apologize again, because I know that you just lost your mother and you have been grieving, and I that's why I'm honored to have you on as well today, Miriam. But during the time, there was a gymnastic doctor. His name was Larry Nassar, and he pleaded guilty, and it was supposed to have happened, I believe, in 2018 is when he went to court. But he ended up going to prison, and this was a high-profile case, and he was recently stabbed, and I believe it was, they said, multiple times in the neck, in the chest, in the back, and he had a collapsed lung. But the first thing that they say is, first of all, the person that did it is not going to be charged. They're not going to get charged for it. Secondly, they said he was stabbed multiple times because of saying something while watching the television with these gymnastics, saying something about it. This doctor was so ashamed of what he did that he did not, I am sure, that he did not say anything negative. But the thing is, of all the girls, the women, young women that this happened to, one of them was on TV the other day and said that she wanted to see him be held accountable for what he did. And she said going to prison was being held accountable. But she said she did not want to see him suffer the way that they are making him suffer. So again, the mentality of individuals.
Exactly. And what you see is, has he been stabbed by another prisoner?
He was stabbed by another prisoner.
Yeah, so the other prisoner who stabbed him also has never received rehabilitation. So what you see, and I don't care what crime somebody has done. At the moment he is in prison, his sentence is his punishment, but the treatment still should be humane. Because you cannot make a distinction between that prisoner deserves to be stabbed and another prisoner does not deserve to be stabbed or whatever. Because that's the wrong path. And the fact that it's possible that, you know, these stabbings take place, but there's so much more that takes place, that shows the sickness of the system. Because it's all based on this judgmental sphere. It's all based on ongoing retaliation, ongoing revenge and all that. And that's the sickness of the system. So it doesn't matter what crime this person has committed. He serves a sentence for that. That's his punishment. No more, no less.
And the sad thing about it is right now he's in stable condition. But this happened Sunday at United States Penitentiary Coleman. And Nassar was in stable condition on Monday. But the sad thing about it is they are fixing him up. They are going to save him. But at the same time, he got, I forgot how many life sentences. So you could see the remorse on his face. And he's fragile. You could see the remorse on his face. And to have to be saved from this traumatic experience, to know that he's going to be serving all these years with no hope, and it's going to probably happen again. And it said that the guards, the two guards that were on duty at the time, they said, it said the were working mandated overtime shifts because of shortages of staff. They would not have shortages of staff if the prison system was running accurately. I don't think so, because a lot of prisoners talk about the good guards, the good correctional officers, and they also talk about the corrupt ones, the bad ones, the abusive ones. And so this is where I think the prisons need to have oversight. They need to be independent oversight, because this needs to stop.
Yes, this does need to stop, and there is no independent oversight. That's true. That's missing. That's why all these things can happen, and nobody seems to care about it, because it happens so frequently in all in all kinds of states. But they don't seem to care, because it's also crazy that there's always a shortage of staff. But it's also crazy that that guards who are abusive, who are sensitive for this power, that they can get away with this, that they are still walking around the prison, that they, these accidents are not exceptions, but they are regular. That's what I wrote in my book. It's part of the system. This is part of the system. This is part of how the system functions. The abuse is part of it. It's not an exception.
Thank
you. And that's the whole thing. It is like, sometimes I think there are some parties who benefit from so much from mass incarceration that they do everything to maintain it as it is. Because it's an interesting question to think for yourself. It could be an interesting question to ask yourself, who benefits from mass incarceration? Otherwise, it would have been banished a long time ago. We know what is happening. And still, it is happening.
I think pilot projects, and this has been brought up on a few occasions, I think pilot projects needs to be established in the United States in these prisons. And these pilot projects, as someone said once before, let the incarcerated individuals choose which guards, which correctional officers they want to have in these pilot projects. And if we see success, then we know it's not the incarcerated, it's the ones that are overseeing them, the correctional officers. And I think that letting the prisoners choose who they want to be their guards, their projects, I think that makes a big difference. I think it makes
a big difference. But also what you have mentioned in the past, do you have social workers in the prison system?
Now, see, they have case managers in the prison system.
Yeah, but that's something else. In our prison system, we have guards who are there purely for the safety and security. Then we have a level of social worker, and they do the daily job with the prisoners. They are not for the security. That's another level. But we have a level of, because we do also have case managers, but that's not the same. The case manager has a few prisoners. He looks after that. So if a prisoner has some things he needs to ask, he goes to his case manager. But on the work floor, during the day, there are some, I call them social workers, who do, who do the work with the prisoners during the day. So there are different levels of workers. And the security guards are different.
I noticed that in the Norway prisons, and I'm sure in your areas too, they say the correctional officers, and even with Franz Dahl, the former warden, they interact with the incarcerated on a normal basis, on a regular, as they are speaking with other human beings. In the United States, they don't treat them like that. They don't talk to them the way that you do in
exactly.
your country.
Exactly. Exactly. And when, you know, with this, when you think about this, what we talk about now, and then we go back to your example of this man who was stabbed in prison. The prisoner who stabbed, who did that, he also does not connect to his human, the humanity inside himself. So, you know, the man who was stabbed was a victim. But the other man, the other prisoner who did the stabbing, he is also a victim. He is a victim of the system. Mm-hmm. And that's the sickness of the system. In the end, you cannot say anymore who is the bad guy or who is a good guy, because they both are part of this violent system. That's even with abusive guards, because when you look at the training of guards, it's only, I believe it's only a few months. They don't get, normally you should think about, you know, if you want to become a guard, you should have a training and education for 1 or 2 years. You have to learn about the psychology of the incarcerated individual, because incarceration in itself has a huge impact on the psyche of a human being, even in the Netherlands or in Norway, or does it matter where, incarceration itself. So, and a guard should learn about that. But that's all absent. So a guard does not learn how to deal with his own issues. You see sometimes that, sometimes, I think more than sometimes, that guards have the room and the possibility to commit the same crimes in the prison as the offenders have committed in the streets. But they can commit it in prison without hardly any consequences, because it never stops. When you look at abuse of women, there are so many reports of what has happened in different prisons in different states. So that's for me, the system itself, the underlying structure, that's the problem. And everybody is a victim of that structure. Because I don't know what would happen to me if I would work in the American prison system day in, day out. What would it do to me as a human being, as a guard? I don't know. But I could never do that. I could never work in your prison system.
I mentioned before, I had a friend, she was a psychiatric nurse, or I have a friend. She's a psychiatric nurse, and she worked in one of the prisons in the Midwest. And she got along good with a lot of the guards until she started seeing some of the abuses that were going on between the guards and the prisoners. And when she spoke up, when she spoke out about it, all the guards turned against her. You know, the corrupt guards, somehow the others, I guess they were afraid to go against their corrupt peers, but they stopped talking to her. They completely ignored her. And she ended up leaving eventually, but it's sad because she was a psychiatric nurse. She's seeing the things that go on. One of these days I'm going to talk to her about coming on. But she just like yourself, she saw so much that shouldn't have been taking place inside the penal system. But yet she was one of the brave ones to speak up, and the guards all turned against her. So this is what goes on.
Exactly, and that's why the system keeps moving on. That's why the system doesn't, it's in the system, because there is also this abuse of power, abuse of power with guards, you know, to the guards themselves.
Yeah.
So you see this power play on all levels.
Another thing I'd like to bring up is the fact that, and you may have said this before or others have said it, they think that the prison officials, prison correctional officers, they should all be randomly and periodically tested for substances themselves or even mental health issues. They should be evaluated at times as well. And I think because there are people that are employed with the system that have also committed suicide. So they have, like you say, they have the same problems.
Yes, a lot of workers in the system, like guards and other staff, they have the same issues as prisoners have, because prisoners are as human as the staff. We talk about all, you know, they are all humans. But, you know, when I did my education to become a therapist, I had, in my education, I had to go through my own therapeutic process. It was part of my education, because they told me that I have to get to know myself first and my issues first before I can be there for somebody else. I have to understand myself, my own issues, my own vulnerabilities. Otherwise, I cannot help somebody else. That also counts for the staff in a prison. If a guard is able to physically or mentally abuse a prisoner or sexually abuse a female prisoner, then this guard has serious problems, serious issues in his own private life. But he might not be aware of that because, you know, nobody talks about it.
And there's no evaluation.
So if I work in the prison system and I feel this need to overpower the prisoners, that I have a power issue, then I have to go to see a therapist for myself, because then I have a very big problem for myself. But nobody talks about this.
I think that's what lacks in this country, is people don't talk about the real issues, you know.
No, and a lot of people don't talk about themselves. Not in that way. I think if you want to work as a guard in a prison, that's a heavy job. Not only because of security, safety, and all that, but also because these people, prisoners, they are violent and vulnerable at the same time.
Yeah.
And they are incarcerated. And as I said, incarceration in itself does a lot with the brain, does a lot with the psyche. And a guard has to be aware of that. He has to have knowledge about it. So he needs education about it. But it's never given. It's only training based, like a military training based on security and all that. But the psychological part is completely missing. It's completely missing.
And the media. What are your thoughts about this? I believe, and I keep saying it, the media needs to go into the penal system, the prison. The media needs to report both sides of a story, because we always hear the one-sided story. If something happens with a prison official or a guard, the media reports it. If it happens to a prisoner, it's always the prisoner's fault for everything that happens. And I believe that they need to get more involved in going into the prisons. Again, media should be allowed to go in, even though they say that they're not allowed to. They're allowed to go all over the world to get news of other countries and things that are going on. Yet they cannot go in the prisons in their own countries to find the truth.
No, and sometimes if they are allowed to go in, then it's prepared so you don't see a true picture. Then you see an ideal picture. That happens too. I think media is also privatized and very biased. When I want to watch through American news of what's really happening, then I have to go to YouTube. I cannot see it in the real media, because the normal media, what you see on television, is all privatized. And the media tells people what they are told them to say. So they are not honest. They are very biased. And they get paid a lot of money for that, to bring the news, what you see on television, is not a real news. I like when you watch Sometimes I watch news from Noam Chomsky is somebody who knows a lot about the United States, the real United States. There are so many big names, but they never get in the real news, in the television news, because they say what they don't want to hear. So, yes, so there's so much fake. The news is fake.
Yeah, I believe
and
it
there
now.
Are, and there are even now, there are American citizens who say that the United States has the best juridical, has a juridical system in the world. They still believe that your prisons are perfect.
Yeah.
I've seen that too. So I think, wow, you're sleeping with your eyes open.
Mass incarceration should tell it all. Mass incarceration should tell it all. If it's so good,
of course,
we would not have mass incarceration, nor would we have so many high rates of suicide in the prisons.
Exactly. But, you know, when you look at the death penalty, when you look at a life without parole, it's a shame that your country, a Western country, has these punishments on a big scale.
Yeah.
Life without parole. You have life without parole on a big scale. They are not exceptions. It happens so much. And that's a death. That's in fact a slow death penalty. It's the same. It might even be worse, because if you have a death penalty, you can go and appeal for many times. Life without parole, forget it.
Yeah.
So it's so, I have no words for it. It's more than inhumane. I even have no words for it, that we as a species can do that to each other. I will never be able to understand it. My brain cannot understand that.
I think the species that you're talking about in the U.S. are barbarians, not anything other than barbarians, because only barbarians would think about these types of punishment for anyone. But as a psychosocial therapist, I have a question for you, Mariam, and I'd like to have insight on this. Recently, there's been a lot of discussion about raising the age limit of criminal responsibility to 25 and 26. I believe California was looking at 26. What are your thoughts on raising the age, age of responsibility, criminal responsibility to mid-20s rather than
what
to age 20?
Do you then mean that, explain a little bit more about it? Can you explain
the mentality of, you know, a lot of times kids do things without, because of age, they're not mature enough and they do things without thinking. And a lot of times they would go to the Department of Youth Services. If they committed a crime, they'd go to the Department of Youth Services until they were of age, you know, to say 18 or 21. And now the football players, they came out with this thing about the CT. I can't remember what the name of it was, but these football players that had been hit in the head numerously, and it did something to the brain. So this is another issue that they talk about is, they just recently found there was a female athlete that had the same thing happen with her. So they're talking about the different psychological traumas or the psychological manner of thinking to determine if these people that commit these crimes, if they should have the age of responsibility increased or up to 25, 26 years of age rather than 18 or 21.
Yeah, I think what I've learned, I have done an education for a teacher, and what I learned from that is in my education was that the human brain is fully developed around the age of 25. I think that when they are younger, then you should hold them accountable on their level. I will give an example. Years ago, when my son was 14 years old, he stole something from a shop. So he was accountable for what he did. And he had to go to the police. He did get a, and he had to go to the police, and he got a kind of a course. There were multiple meetings he had to learn about what he had done, what the consequences can be, what it does to a victim, and all that. But it was on his level, and he learned a lot from that. That was his quote-unquote punishment. So mm-hmm. I think raising the age to 25, I think it's good, but I also think that on every level, you can hold a child accountable, but then on the level of the development of that child.
Yeah, age. Because I connect this with the life and life without parole, life sentences, death penalty. I think that these people, especially when they graduate from high school, they're still in school because a lot of them go on to college. You know, so they're still... But I know a lot of kids, when they're getting ready to graduate, they don't know what they're going to do with their life beyond high school. And a lot of times they seem to be frightened because they don't know what they're going to be. They're now becoming adults. And what are they going to do from there? So some might join the military. Some might end up going to college. And some might end up just getting jobs, you know, out there getting jobs. But they're at a point now where they have to make a decision. What are they going to do? They're adults. So I just feel myself that when they're unsure, they're still kids. They're trying to figure out which way they're going to go. And sometimes when they do go to college, they're still in school, they're still students, they're still, you know, they haven't gotten out there really as an adult because they're still working on their future. So a lot of these things, I think that raising the age of criminal responsibility, as you say, everyone needs to be held accountable for whatever they do. And there's a lot of people that in this country that if you get caught under the influence, driving under the influence, and you go to court, they're going to, a lot of times they give you community services. You have to go out there and do something positive in the community. So they will set you up, or you yourself have to set yourself up, contact some of these nonprofits or contact some of these places where you can do that community services, whether it go out and do the cleanup duties or whether it work for an organization. But they do have accountability, but it's not going to prison. It's not going
exactly
to prison.
Exactly. And I think because what you say about these community services, that's what we have here too, and I think that's very positive. Prison is not always the answer, and especially not when they are still kids. It's only traumatizing. I think incarceration for a kid is really traumatizing, no matter what he has done. And again, but that counts for kids, but also for adults. What should be done is people should look at what is the cause of the crime. How did he come so far, that person? Whether it's a child, I don't know if a child has a difficult youth or, you know, there can be so many things, you know, that has happened, that are happening in his youth. I mean, my kids has a stable family. So, yeah, I see that makes it easier for them to grow up, and they also make mistakes, but those are little mistakes. I mean, but... are so many aspects that lead, you know, that lead to that crime, and they have to be investigated, and that's what's not happening. They only look at the crime and they say punish the guy or whatever, and I think with kids it's even more vulnerable because, you know, they are in the beginning and they have to make these big choices in life, and in your country it's very difficult to survive if you're not a millionaire. My country is not paradise, but it's a little bit easier here to live than in your country because, you know, the privatization of social things, we have that more here. You know, everybody has access to healthcare, everybody has access to schools, everybody has access to university and all that. We can pay that. We pay a lot of taxes. But, you know, we do not really have homelessness. We don't have these issues. There's So that makes it easier for younger people to grow up. They have more, they have the safety more. You see, but in your country, it's very difficult. I mean, if I would live in your country, I never could afford a university to study philosophy, and in my country, I could.
Yeah, and another thing we don't. Go ahead.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Well, what you see is that a lot of young people who want to go to university, or they all end up in this big debt. They all have to have this debt of thousands of dollars they cannot pay back. You have so many issues in your country.
Well, the president, well, current president, is trying to do away with the student debt. But I was going to say real quickly, in this country, our young people are moving fast. And there was a lawyer one time that asked the family of this incarcerated individual if this individual was gay, because this individual was not involved in any relationships. At the age of 23 years old is when that person entered into a first relationship. And the lawyer, his own lawyer, actually said, is he gay? Now, this is somebody that was, after graduating from high school, went to college. And it was in 3 years after going to college that this person got into a relationship for the first time. And to ask if the person is gay because they weren't out there, you know, involved in relationships at the age of 16 or 17. And it struck me when I heard this, because I the United States of America, they're too fast out there. And if you're not keeping up with them, then you're different in certain ways. Then instead of looking into it deeper justice, they automatically assume that somebody is different than what the others think they are, or different than others. And when they start asking questions about somebody being gay because they never dated until the age of 23, or if they, I don't know, it's just so, in this country, it's just unbelievable the way they assume.
It's ultra conservative. And it's getting worse, because you see in multiple states now that rights are gradually taken away, like the right to abortion is taken away, or you made it very difficult. While you can be pro-life or pro-abortion, I don't care, but it's a personal question. It should be a personal thing. It's not something that you cannot politicize that. And it's also with being gay or being straight or whatever. It's very personal. But what you see is now, and what you see in Florida with banning books, it's like you go back for 50 years or something. And that it concerns me, that we talk about prisoner rights, and we talk about, you know, what I wrote in my book about the amendments and how they are very smart, manipulated to keep mass incarceration going. Well, on the same way, you see now that certain rights are step by step taken away. Like, it's more difficult to be gay. It's more difficult to be transgender. And it doesn't matter whether you are, you cannot, I think, in my opinion, you cannot be in support of or against being gay, because being gay is simply the way somebody is born. That's not good or bad. It's simply the way it is. And there's all these judgments, but they are also fed by politics, I think.
Yeah.
And yeah, politics is getting very conservative. Your left party is the right party in my country, and the right party in your country is ultra right in our country. You do not really have a left party anymore, and that concerns me.
Mm.
Because if it's already difficult to protect your rights in a free world, how difficult is it then to protect your rights when you are in prison? So that's concerning.
Exactly. Miriam, we are running out of time, and I'd like to have you give the audience all your contact information. And I'd like to have you back on, if possible, in the next couple of weeks, if you have that availability. We'd be honored to have you on.
I love to be on the show, Leona. As you know, my mother passed away 6 weeks ago, and it's very difficult. Some days it's good, and some days I really miss her. I was always her caregiver, and I have to process some things because it was quite a sudden death. So it takes time. Of course, I will be back on the show, and I have to see how I feel, but we are in contact with each other, and I come back to the show. But I also need time.
Whenever it's not going to be easy, as I mentioned before, losing your mother, especially as close as you were, it's going to be difficult. But you know what? We are here to support you as well as you letting us know about the things that are going on around our own communities, our own being. But anytime, Mariam, you're up to it, please let me know, and we will have you back on. In the meantime, I'd like to have you give the audience your contact information and how they can purchase the book and any other things that you'd like to get out there.
Yeah, thanks for your support, Leona. Thank you very much. Well, you can find me on Facebook with my Facebook page, Deeper Justice, and also, you know, under my own name, Mariam Jacobs. I am also on Instagram with my own name, Facebook, Instagram. I'm on LinkedIn, Mariam Jacobs on LinkedIn. And my book, Suspended Values in Concentration Camp and Prison, is interesting to read if you want to know more about the underlying structures, if you want to think about this issue. You can order it at Amazon in the Netherlands, and they send it to the United States. That's not a problem. I also can order books on Amazon United States, and United States send it to the Netherlands. So you can also do that the other way around. And my publisher is called Maklu, MAKLU. They also send books to the United States. And also my book, so that's not a problem. And that's it.
and Mariam's book, I will say, in the book itself, it talks a lot about the things that are going on in the United States. It talks about the United States penal system, and this is something that many of you have been thinking about, talking about, and worried about. It's a problem that needs to be addressed. A lot of the issues going on in the penal system. And like I say, Mariam, I want to have you come back on because you have been giving so much insight into a lot of the things that have been going on in the United States penal system, prison system, and I really appreciate everything that you've been doing and bringing to us. So it's been a while, and I hope again that you will be on with us in the next few weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. And whenever you are up to it, please let me know.
Thank you very much, Leona.
Thank you. Audience, we are going to be closing now, and I thank all of you for listening in. I hope you enjoyed this series from Mariam Jacobs, again, psychosocial therapist and author of Suspended Values in Concentration Camp and Prison. And you can find her again on Facebook under Deeper Justice. Mariam, thank you so much. We look forward to having you back on again. And again,
thank you.
Take it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello. Hi, Mary. How you doing?
Are you staying cool?
Oh, yeah. Got the air conditioner on. I took my fan back to Ocean State job lot.
Oh, I was wondering if it happened.
I took it back and I told them, I said, if they can get it together, I said, I want another one or I want a refund. And I told them what happened. So they had me get another one and they set it up for me.
Oh, great.
And you know what happened?
Yeah.
I didn't know, and the cashier didn't, the woman that I spoke with, she didn't know, but the guy came over and when he put it together and he said that, and what, you know how you usually turn, when you're turning something to tighten it, you turn it to the right?
Yeah.
In this particular case, the fan, you turn it to the left.
Oh, for God's
and
sake.
That's why I wasn't able to get it screwed in.
Oh, my God.
So, but they were really nice about it and everything. So I ended up bringing it back home and it's got the different levels and everything else. So now it's working. But
oh, yeah.
It wasn't broken. It was just I couldn't screw the last part to hold the blade in.
Oh, that was ridiculous.
Yeah.
They should warn somebody about that, you know?
Yeah.
So does it feel good? Is it strong enough?
Well, you know, it was strong enough, but, you know, last night I turned it on. I shut the air conditioning in the bedroom off and turned that on. But it was good enough. But after a while, it seemed like it was getting hot in the room again. So I think it worked. But it was just last night was just it was I think it was in the mid 70s last night.
I slept with the window open. I didn't even turn on the fan. Believe it or not.
Well, I shut the fan air conditioner off and I cracked the window. See, the thing with me is my windows, if I open the windows, if it's blowing, if the wind is out there, the shade, you know, I have the individual things that come down, and so the wind will be blowing those things all over the place.
Oh, no.
If it was daytime, like now, I can open the blinds, and I can open the windows, but at nighttime, so people can see in, you know, people can see inside these apartments. But that's why if I could open the windows all the time, I wouldn't even have the air conditioner on sometimes.
Oh, I know.
But
I
cracked the window open a little, and then I had the fan going, and it felt good. But then
it felt cool enough to me. It felt cool enough. I was glad, you know.
Yeah.
It was such a sticky day. Oh, my God.
This humidity, that's what it is. If it wasn't for the humidity, I wouldn't have a problem at all.
Yeah, I went to Shaw's yesterday. I got some of that fan on there.
Oh, that's because of your...
Yes, it was so cheap that it's not right. Like, I got 500. I figure I need that, like, you know, to get enough for a meal. So I was so disappointed. And I said, buy something that's so cheap, you know, it was on a big sale.
How much?
$7.99 for your
house. Wasn't
it? So I said, you know, that would be a good meal. I don't fall for that. I do like, you know.
No.
So then I went and I got my inhaler on my shirt and hey, but I think it's working, you know, I think I do it.
Yeah.
So start to taste normal.
Really?
Yeah.
What are you using to do that?
The inhaler. It's the third one I've got.
Is that
I think this will probably be the last one. I hope this is the last one. They're $49 each time.
I'm going to get out of here.
I'm going to get out of here. you know, and
that's what I think. Complaining they were trying to help her without even testing or sending you to the
last year on. You don't need to see what your lungs are fine. She said to me, she hadn't even listened to them. She said they're fine. So I called up a place over on Pearl Street. There's a medical building there. I have their number from Aetna, like, you know?
Yeah.
So there was a place over there that had both set doctors, and I called them up and I said, you have to have a referral from your primary care physician. So thank God, like, you know.
And she never gave her a referral.
Oh, no.
Did you ever watch the building?
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember Dorothy was having some problems? I forgot what it was, and she kept going to her doctor, and he was telling her it was all in her mind and everything. And she finally went to the doctor and found out what the problem was. The others, the three of them were at a restaurant one time, and she saw her doctor there with his wife, and she went over to him, and she told him off. He started to say something to her, and his wife said, "Shut up." And she called her husband by his first name. She said, "Shut up."
No.
She wanted to hear what Dorothy had to say. And
Dorothy said
all that time that she was suffering from this thing, and this doctor kept telling her it was on her head, and she told him exactly what happened. She laid it out on him.
Oh, my God, that's why lots of times they have to tell you, get a second opinion, but it's not easy to get a second opinion. But, I mean, it sound easy. But that was it. If I had gotten that medication last year, I would have to tell you. You know, I went for 2 months. And I followed 10 years ago, I guess, it happened.
And when did they find out about this? I mean, they just started talking about it. Did they find the body or something? Did they find... What did they
find? What happened 10 years ago, they found out about the bodies there. And then seemingly, as soon as they found the bodies there, they stopped. But then they discovered there was something like 11 bodies altogether. They're still trying to identify one, you know?
But when did they find these bodies?
They found the bodies 10 years ago.
Oh, so that... I just started hearing about it. Are they now talking about finding the person that did it, or they're talking about finding the bodies? And
I remember hearing about some way back, like, you know, TV coverage then, but it all happened seemingly 10 years ago. They got killed, and then one girl went missing, I guess, and the mother went. The mother, seemingly she had called the mother to tell the mother somebody was following her.
Oh, they're showing it on CNN now.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, it's all over the news.
He was an architect.
He was an architect and a good life and everything. And look what he did. He fouled it up so bad, like, you know.
He's trying to say, "I did not do this," but they said the DNA on, there was a pizza.
Yeah.
I think he must have bought a pizza or something. And they said that one of the...
Seemingly, it was early last year that they discovered there were all this time, and I guess they were trying to solve the problem because there were so many bodies. Like, you know, seemingly it's 8 women and women and one child.
There's a child, too?
They haven't identified only the 4 girls. For instance, the one that called her and said she was being murdered or followed or something, and then started yelling into the phone, and the mother knew what had happened. So that's when that investigation